Good afternoon. You're very welcome to Kildare Focus. Ciarán Noble here with you until 3 p.m. Coming up now in just about a minute, we'll be speaking with one woman from Newbridge recounting her scary ordeal after a night out whereby she was approached by two males. We have Saoirse Brennan's whole story for you. Orla Keegan is the head of education and bereavement at the Irish Hospice Foundation. They are calling for statutory compassionate leave for grieving workers. Michael Guerin, the senior addiction counsellor at Cún Mhuire, is a time we start normalising sobriety, how to make people who don't drink feel comfortable in social settings. And finally, we'll speak with EPIC, Empowering People in Care, their advocacy officer. Young people who have left care, they're having to sleep in their cars, couch surf, access homeless accommodation, and even sleep in graveyards. Owen did touch on it this morning on Kildare Today. Of course, we'd love to hear from you this afternoon. It's 0833 97 97 97. That is the WhatsApp and the text line. You can also give us a phone, 045-898-999, or email studio@kfmradio.com.
Kildare Focus with Ciarán Noble.
So you may have been listening to the station over the past week, and we did note a young woman from Newbridge had recounted her encounter she had with a stranger in the early hours of a Saturday morning. It was the 23rd of July, and Saoirse Brennan did share her story on social media. She joins me now. How are you, Saoirse?
I'm good, Ciarán. How are you?
I am fine, thank you very much. So just the basics first off, you're 20 years old, you're from Newbridge, you obviously know the area.
Yeah.
And so Friday night, which would have been July the 22nd, you went out. So this is the early hours, as you would after a night out, trying to get back home. Tell me what happened.
So originally me and my friend were in Nate Court Hotel, which was all good, you know, got the bus home with a few friends. And we got into Newbridge, I think, around maybe 5 to or 10 to 4. We got off at McDonald's. So initially, my first thought was, okay, I'll get a taxi home, like, you know, because it was so dark out, blah, blah, blah. So I went onto the Free Now app because obviously there's no taxi services available in Newbridge, like, open. So I went onto the app, and the app was charging me €29 to get from McDonald's to my house, which was 5 minutes up the road, which was absolutely ridiculous.
Just to focus on that for 1 second, in kilometre-wise from McDonald's to your house, are we talking like 2-3 kilometres and a charge of €29?
Oh yeah, it's like maybe 2.5 kilometres away, and it was €29. So, you know, like I just didn't have the money on me at the time, you know, so I was just.
But even if you did have the money, that is absolutely taking the mic.
It is ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Because I actually did have Jim Waldron on. He's of the National Taxi and Hire Association. And when I read your story on social media last week, I actually put that to him. We were discussing something else. We were discussing the app actually Free Now increasing their base level charges, you know, before you get into the taxi.
Yeah.
And I was noting your €29 and the few kilometres. And, you know, he was obviously making note. That's absolutely ridiculous. So
it was absolutely ridiculous. Now, before we went, we were going to get a taxi, but like initially it was charged me, I think it took €17 off me at the start. Now this is at like 11 o'clock to go from Newbridge to Nate, and it was €17. They took off my card instantly, and then when we got to Nate they have the meter as well, so it added up to maybe €22. So they took the extra few like euro off me then as well, along with the €17 that they had already took off me, which was absolutely ridiculous.
But, and I think it's important to note things like this when, unfortunately, we're discussing horrible situations like you did experience. We'll get to that in a moment. But it starts with a situation like that. I don't need to tell anybody. We know we're living in a cost of living crisis. It's a really difficult time. It was a hard 2.5 years with, you know, COVID cases rampant.
Yeah.
But people are trying to save every penny they possibly can. People, you know, in their 20s trying to buy houses, things like that. It's basically impossible if you're to do so being single. So money means a lot. So if there's anybody who would say to you, oh, but why wouldn't you get in the taxi even if it was €29? I think the vast majority of the public can understand why you would refuse a taxi.
Yeah, exactly. And like, it's not even that here. Like, when the taxi services are open in the town, like, it all well is all good, you know, because it's only €6 up the town, or like some places would charge you €6 or €7, and it's totally fine. But like an extra €22 on top of that is just absolutely ridiculous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So like it was just like,
so you opted then
to walk it.
And, yeah, like, exactly. And that's what you chose to do. You opted to walk.
Yeah, but like obviously the last thing that's going to come into your head is like you hear the stories and you never think it's going to be you until it actually happens to you. So obviously I had the mindset of, oh, it's fine, like I know the town, like I know places to hide, I know this, like I know this person and I know this place. And but like that's just not the case at all. Like I've grew up in Newbridge my whole life, and like it was just like you just don't think it's going to happen to you, you know, that kind of
so
way.
So bringing you back, you're at McDonald's, you don't accept a €29 ride from Free Now. So you walk from McDonald's.
So we walk from McDonald's.
Walk through that.
So my friend, they've kind of, you know, they parked where kind of side of it. So we were walking up towards Neeson's, and at that stage we kind of parted ways because she was obviously going down her way and I had to go down my way. So we were walking down through the town thinking it was, oh, this is great, like it's lit up, it's fine, nothing will happen, because there is another way into her estate which is really dodgy. So we actually just avoided that altogether. So we walked through the town, we parted ways, and then I began walking then. So I came from, like, from the town towards Station Road, like, so if you know Newbridge, it'd be from Penny's towards the train station, kind of.
Yep.
So was walking down, that was fine, was kind of aware of my surroundings at all, like, because I'm just very aware anyways, I'm just very, like, I'm very on all the time. But I didn't see anybody walking, like, I didn't see anybody behind me, which was kind of, it kind of put me in a bit of a panic stage, but I was like, it's fine, like, my house is only, what, a 10-minute walk away, it's fine. But I got to, like, just the start of the playground where all them bushes are, just the start, and I turned, like, I could hear a car, so all I just assumed it was a taxi just driving around, because, you know, you just assume that they're the only cars.
Yeah, Friday night. Yeah.
And I seen this car coming from Air Street, which would be the back street in Newbridge, and it was coming my direction, so I instantly pulled out my phone, pretended I was on the phone, but I heard the car rev, like I heard it sped up. And then it slowed right down then, and I knew, okay, like, this isn't good, like, what is happening? So I instantly knew what was kind of going down before it actually went down. So he stopped right across from me, and it was a gold Merc with an English reg, so it was like a yellow reg. And I didn't actually get a look at the driver, but they stopped, like, right across where I was walking. And I'm actually just shaking. I'm talking about it.
Do you know what's so funny? Just as you began to speak about the actual sighting of the car, immediately your voice changed. Like, you could hear that, because it has to be said, what a scary experience you went through. And, you know, you one of the first things you also said there was, you're always aware. And unfortunately, I think as a woman, and many people won't like me saying this, but it's just a fact, you're hyper aware.
You're always aware, like, whether it's day or night, like, I'm just, like, I think, like, I leave my friend said it as well, like, she's just always switched on, like, you just can't, you're not safe anywhere anymore, do you know? And it's not even just women, but women are the targets in general, do you know, that kind of way. And it's horrible, and I'm going to get so slandered for saying that, but it's genuinely just the truth, do you know what I mean? And I'm not saying that men don't get attacked or they don't get abducted. Like, I'm not saying that, but it's just...
Yeah, more women, statistically, you know, more women are affected by that. And I think that's what you're saying. Look, if I can bring you back to that moment, I know it's really hard to recall and to go back through it, but you noticed the gold car across from you. You went onto the phone. You did the basic things that would help in a situation like that.
So
what happened then?
I just assumed that, you know, going on my phone, like they'll think, oh, I'm on the phone to someone, like, they won't come near me, but that just wasn't the case at all. It just shows, you know. But I was kind of on the side of the medical centre, and they pulled across from, like, right across the road from me, and it was literally, like, it wasn't, like, further up, it wasn't back, it was just right across the road from me, and I seen the man get out of the car, and he was just, he had, like a smile, it was almost like, I have you, do you know, it was almost like, he had that message in his face saying, I have you now, do you know that kind of, and it was just horrible.
I saw you say a threatening smile.
Yeah, like a threatening smile it was, it definitely was. And he started, like, walking briskly, like almost running towards me. And I just began to say, like, F off, like, do not come near me, don't touch me, get away from me. And I started to, like, walk away from him as I was doing this. And I was like, no, get away from me. Like, and then he began to circle around me as if his objective was to, like, grab me or something. And I pulled out my phone and I said, I'm recording you, I'm ringing the guards, the guards are on the phone, I have your red, get away from me, don't touch me. I was shouting because I was inside houses, so I, like, obviously I was thinking, okay, what if I shout help, but what help isn't enough, you know? So maybe if I make a big deal, people are going to look out their window and be like, oh, what's going on outside, you know?
But seriously, you said, like, you're so good on the spot there. Not many people would think of that. You know, you got the phone out, you're saying about the guards, you know, you're telling them things like, oh, I have your reg, like all the basic things that, you know, someone would tell you in terms of advice if one ever got into that situation. Like, horrific for you, but you handled it so well.
Thank you. But it was just like, I think it's just because I was aware of what, like, if I didn't see, like, if I was jogging or if I had headphones in, or, you know, like Ashley Murphy, God rest her, but like, if, like, she had earphones in, like, and she's like, obviously if I had earphones in, I wouldn't have heard the car, I wouldn't have seen anything, like, but like the fact I knew the car was coming in my direction, I could kind of mentally prepare myself for what was about to happen.
You start shouting at him, you tell him, you know, you have the red, you say the guards are on the phone, what happens then? He's kind of circling around you.
And then he's like, he begins to tell me, oh, calm down, darling, it's okay, calm down, and, like, it's fine, like, why are you shouting, calm down? And then he, like, began to get back into the car. But at that stage, like, he had a mask on and out, like, he didn't have a mask on getting out of the car or anything, like... And
when you say a mask, do you mean a COVID, like a mask for COVID-19, like, around the mouth?
No, it was just like, it was a kind of like, do you know, like them headbands that people wear, like the, how do I explain? They're like bandanas.
Yeah.
He had one of them, like maybe it was tucked under, like, I don't know, but he just pulled it out of the blue and I couldn't see his face anymore. And he got back into the car and they sped off then into, like, in the direction of the train station. So I immediately pulled out my phone, rang my dad. My dad was about to pick me up anyways, which was fine, but, like, it was obviously in the middle of the night, and after the whole taxi thing, he obviously wasn't up straight away, so he was getting ready, and this had obviously happened. So I ran, I just pegged it down towards the town again and back towards my friend's house. So I rang my dad. He was like, okay, I'll get you at Sarah's house, blah, 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 blah. Then I rang my friend. I was like, you need to come back, like, you need to run up, and literally after nearly being kidnapped, like, you need to help me, blah, 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 blah. So she ran back up towards me then, and every car that drove, like, there was only one or two cars that drove by where I was walking when I got from that place of where I was walking.
Yeah. So,
and every single car that drove by, I hid behind a car, or I hid behind a bin, or hid behind something so that they wouldn't see me walking, because I immediately thought they were going to speed up, turn around and come back for me.
And Saoirse, like, after anybody goes through something traumatic or something that has panicked them or, you know, caused panic in them, it stays with you. And I'm sure for a long time. So I want to touch on that before you leave. But just in terms of your, you know, you're obviously very, very distressed at this stage. You've gone back in the direction of your friend's house. Your dad does come and pick you up and you guys decide to go to the Garda station.
Yeah, so I met my friend, and, like, looking back at it now, I was kind of really silly because I was like, why did I tell her to come out and get me, like, run back up towards me? Like, the same thing would have happened to her, but... It was just like, it was just a...
In fairness, you're in panic, yeah.
The first thing that came into my head. Because I knew she would be awake and she was there, and I was literally waiting 10 minutes ago, 5 minutes ago, and ran back towards her. I waited at her house, my dad picked me up, and I said, Dad, look, I'm nearly after been abducted, we need to go to the guard station. And his whole face just went white. He was like, what? Like, are you for real? And I said, yeah, he genuinely thought I was messing. And I said, no, Dad, I'm being serious. We need to go to the guard station. So we went then, and my dad was saying to me, he's like, you know what? I actually seen two or three girls walking by themselves when I was coming to get you. And I felt like stopping them and saying, here, do you need a lift? But obviously you can't in these days because of what happened to me. Do you know the kind of way?
So yeah, you're wary.
He was just kind of like, oh, my God, like, there's actually people thinking that it's okay to walk home. And I said, but we should be made feel that it's okay to walk home,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Yeah, that's...
Like, we should be able to walk home safely. We should be... Like, my house is only 10 minutes away, Kira, from Neeson's. Do you know what I mean? Like, I should be able to walk home by myself.
Completely. Safe, you know? It doesn't matter what time of day it is, you know, all women, yeah, all people, forget about the gender, should be able to walk home. And that's the crux, yeah, of it. I know people are only have their concern for you and they say, oh, God, you know, don't be walking home by yourself and stuff like that. But that's not the point. The principle is, you know, it, like, should be able to be happening. So you went, yeah, to the Garda station. You obviously gave as much details as you could. And the Gardaí have said that inquiries are currently ongoing.
So I went to the Gard and basically because I wasn't able to give a statement there and then, so I had to come in the next evening and give my statement, and so far it's just been ongoing and inquiries have been ongoing and they've just been looking into it a lot more.
So yeah, that's the update as of right now.
Yeah.
Going forward into the future, would you ever walk home again?
Well, to be honest, Kira, I don't see myself going anywhere by myself, day or night. I actually don't see myself, whether it's walking through Whitewater Shopping Centre, whether it's walking to my friend's house, nothing. Like, whether it's 3 o'clock in the day or 3 o'clock in the morning, I would never be walking, like, anywhere by myself. Not PTSD, I don't want to say that, but it is kind of traumatic because it keeps replaying in my head.
Absolutely.
The whole night, and it just keeps making me feel the exact same way that I felt that night, you know?
And so, as I said, the minute you started speaking about when the car pulled up, your voice automatically changed. That just shows, you know, trauma. And to deal with that, Saoirse, how are you getting on over the past few weeks? Are you speaking with somebody? Are you finding certain things, you know, you're mentioning you don't want to walk by yourself, but are you finding other things difficult? You know, how do you hope to, I guess, deal with this in the future and take such a horrible incident and make best of it, I guess?
I'm not talking to anyone professional, but my family have been a really good support system. My friends have been a really good support system. Like, anybody, like, no one kind of, like, wants me to go anywhere by myself. Like, my 12-year-old sister is texting me every 10 minutes, are you okay? Are you okay? Do you know, like, it's just little things like that that's kind of, you know, like, telling me, okay, Saoirse, you are, like, someone is there with you all the time. Like, don't ever be stuck. Don't ever feel that you need to do that anymore. Or, you know, like, it's just, I feel like now I am petrified to walk anywhere by myself. That's a given. But I think, and I know this might sound so bad, but when I'm around men now, like, any form of a man, I don't, like, it's just given me a severe anxiety in my stomach drops. And I know I shouldn't, and I know it's not all men, and I'm not saying that it's all men, but it's just a thing that I will have now for I don't know how much longer. But because...
It has naturally happened in that situation because, unfortunately,
exactly,
the traumatic,
yeah, so
situation,
like,
involved a man. And
yeah.
Saoirse, obviously, we thank you so much for coming on and letting us know about your story. We are not trying to put the fear of God into people. We are just trying to make sure that, you know, everybody stays safe. As Saoirse said, you know, it's not all men. Nobody is saying anything close to that. But it's just the advice for people out there to always be aware. But as Saoirse pointed out, she was always aware. She did everything she possibly could do. Even in that moment, you hear she made the best decisions, you know, saying things like, I'm on the phone, I have your registration number, you know, the guards are on the phone to me, get away. She's screaming, she's making noise, she's making herself be seen and heard, I guess, in a moment like that, scaring people away that would want to, I guess, go anywhere near you at that time. So it has to be said, you really handled that so well. Not that that makes
you
feel
so
any
much.
Better.
And thank you so much for listening to me as well, Kira. Thanks.
Oh, Saoirse, it was really lovely to speak with you. I only hope that you feel better soon. And it's lovely to hear, though, that you have such great support from your friends and family, because that is what everybody needs in life. And Saoirse,
yeah,
we wish you only the best. Thank you so much for sharing
your
story.
Thank you so much, Kira.
Kildare Focus with Kira Noble.
Calls for statutory compassionate leave are growing for grieving workers. Compassionate leave has been increasingly discussed in more and more workplaces and by employees and maybe even employers. And this afternoon I'm joined by Orla Keegan. She is the head of education and bereavement with the Irish Hospice Foundation. How are you, Orla?
Hello there, Kira.
Statutory leave, I think it's needed in so many different situations in life, but today obviously we're focusing on compassionate leave for those who are grieving. From your point of view, just how important is it?
Well, look, it's an absolutely essential component of good bereavement care. And, you know, good bereavement care is about compassion from everyone when you need it. We say here in the Hospice Foundation that bereavement is everybody's business. And people who are employed, you know, they don't leave their grief at the door. You know, this impacts the whole of their life. So certainly, we think it's a huge issue. We do talk about bereavement leave as being essential, but we also are at pains to point out that it's only part of the solution. And, you know, in an ideal workplace, there would also be maybe a bereavement policy. There'd be training for managers. And a lot of flexibility around the fact that people meet grief differently and they cope with grief differently, and the workplace needs to accommodate all of that.
So at the moment, it's up to the employer, it's at their discretion to decide if any leave is given to workers due to bereavement, etc. You, in your role at the Irish Hospice Foundation, what have you heard in general from people? Do they feel supported by and large by, I would say, Irish employers, specifically in this country?
Yeah, we hear, I suppose, the whole spectrum of experience. Our most recent survey in 2018, the end of 2018, again, we asked people, well, what do you need from your employer should you end up being bereaved? And the most, I suppose, frequent response was, we want compassion. Leave came as the third point, not the first point. So three quarters of the people were saying we want to be treated with compassion.
Now, what does that mean, do you think?
I think it really means that people stop in the workplace and acknowledge what's after happening to you. You know, somebody who is a huge part of your life is gone. So mostly the first step of compassion is a manager reaching out and acknowledging, I've heard this has happened, I'm here with you, I will take over anything you need me to take over, and I will work with you on this.
When someone's grieving, Orla, they're grieving for life, most people will word it as. And, you know, time can pass and people can become, you know, numb to situations. We look at what happened in Ukraine in February, the outpouring of love and the response most Irish people gave is probably different to right now, this date, because people do become numb to other people's pain. When one is grieving, they can feel so isolated and maybe feel under pressure that they don't want to bring up the fact that they are still suffering with this loss.
Absolutely, and we hear that an awful lot from bereaved people. And I suppose the one thing that a bereaved person fears most is that the person who has died is forgotten. Now, if people aren't asking, how are you since your mother died? And if people aren't mentioning your mother in conversation, you know, bringing back up stories about her, including the fact that she existed and that she was important in conversation, then that is isolating a bereaved person. So we always promote, just risk it, reach out, ask a person how they are, and talk about the people who have died.
Would I be wrong to say, Orla, that Irish people find that particularly difficult?
I think all nationalities find it particularly difficult. There's a real sense of just awkwardness and embarrassment and the fear of upset. You know, so that's why people tend not to reach out. It's just not wanting to cause upset or hurt and feeling embarrassed. Invariably, bereaved people say, it was like it had never happened. I see people crossing the road and I wish people would have acknowledged what was happening to me. So I guess our advice is just
risk it and just wait you out.
And Orla, if you go back to the employers, there are some stories of people having, like, undoubtedly you're going to have an awful time, but having an awful time in particular going back to work. You know, they may have gotten leave for the funeral or the wake or whatever it may have been, but they were back to work within a few days. And, you know, some people saying they were literally forced out of their job or feeling like they were basically forced out of their job. Some quotes saying it nearly ruined them. If that is somebody who's listening today, they feel like they're just in that bad of a situation when it comes to their employer. What's the type of advice you could give to them?
I think there's two audiences to this. There's people who are in that situation and there are people who are employers and managers. The working relationship is a relationship, and everything that an employer or a manager inputs into their employees, to their people, they reap in spades. It's a good investment to look after your people, particularly when they are most at need, which is when they're bereaved. So I'd really say to employers to plan for the inevitable. Some of your staff will meet bereavement, and sometimes it will be sudden and tragic, other times it might be expected. As an organisation, you should have a policy around this. Your managers should be educated and prepared to deal with it. And you should have protocols about how to help a person to return to work. And you should have check-ins in terms of, you know, how to work with them over the coming months. We should be considering diversity in these policies. Diversity in terms of nationality, gender, your time in life. So I think if employers hear that, they're in a good position to develop those sort of policies. And I think employees are entitled to raise issues with their managers and with their colleagues. And it doesn't have to be antagonistic. Sometimes, precisely because of the embarrassment that you've talked about earlier, you know, pain can be caused, you know, by ignorance or neglect. So sometimes it is up to a bereaved person to say, look, I'm finding this very difficult. And maybe they're working in a public facing part of the organisation, and maybe it's just too much to be standing at a counter for 7 days, for 7 hours a day. Maybe you could look at, well, can we offer some flexibility in this? Maybe if you work the back room for the mornings and just do the afternoon shift, public facing. But if the employee isn't surfacing the problem, the manager may not recognise it. So it's a relationship.
Okay, well, we appreciate that advice this afternoon. That is Orla Keegan. She's the Head of Education and Bereavement at the Irish Hospice Foundation. Thank you, Orla. And just to remind people, the Irish Hospice Foundation does have a bereavement support line. You can contact them. It's 1800 80 70 77. So 1800 80 70 77. Lots of details on the Irish Hospice website about nurses for night care, thinking ahead, the impact. If you're looking at 2021 for the Irish Hospice Foundation, 2,729 nights of the nurses for night care service, over 1,382 calls answered on the Irish Hospice Foundation bereavement support line, over 2,800 attended training workshops on dying, death and bereavement, 29 community groups supported with the seed grants in 12 counties across Ireland, over 70 compassionate community network sessions for 6 communities exploring loss, and 46 families were directly supported. That's through Rosabelle Rooms following the loss of a child. And you can find out more information about all that on the Irish Hospice website. It's hospicefoundation.ie. That bereavement support line, once again, 1800 80 7077.
Kildare Focus with Ciarán Noble.
Well, my attention was drawn to an article or an online thread on social media the other day that simply asked the question, is it time that we start normalising sobriety and supporting people out there who want to go out and have a night out or a social occasion but don't want to drink, and how can we make them feel more comfortable? And it sparked a thought within me. Should should we have this conversation over the airwaves? And we said we'd get in touch with Michael Guerin, who's a senior addiction counsellor at Coonwira. He's been on with us previously. Michael, good afternoon and welcome to the programme again.
Good afternoon, Owen, and good to talk to you as always.
Yeah, I think it is an important question and an important conversation that needs to be started, because we have seen, even over the last couple of years, a rise in those who are maybe choosing non-alcoholic drinks or choosing to go out and not drink any type of beer at all and choosing a soft drink.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and in the course of our work in Coonwira, we come across people who have to stop drinking because their drinking is problematic. And they frequently in aftercare regale us with stories of amusing incidents that they have because they are seen as somewhat abnormal within greater society by virtue of the fact that they do not drink. And I recall a lady telling me recently she had stopped drinking about a year and she was at a function taking a soft drink, and she was continually being asked by people whom she came across, friends, she was asked, was she driving, was she pregnant, or was she on some sort of medication? In other words, that it wasn't socially acceptable for people to go out and simply not to drink. And I suppose in Ireland, historically, we have had a normalisation of intoxication on occasions, where people saw it as being normal to go out to certain occasions and functions and drink too much, and that was perfectly okay. Really and truly now we need to be looking at the normalisation of people, certainly who have alcohol problems and elect to stop, but more so a body of people who choose not to drink, not necessarily because they are problematic drinkers, but they feel it is the right thing for them to do.
It's interesting that you tell that story about the woman who was constantly asked what the reason was that she wasn't drinking, because that is something that people are so worried about when they go out, is what excuse can I come up with? Do I have to say that I'm in work early in the morning, that I'm not drinking, that I'm driving, or as you say, that that woman had to say she was on antibiotics or whatever the case may be. That is something that people find the most difficult, is maybe the first couple of months. How am I going to get around people realising I don't drink anymore?
Yes, and I suppose there is a cultural kind of an issue that one almost has to justify the fact that they are electing to take a non-alcoholic beverage over taking alcohol in social situations. And I suppose it speaks to our greater attitude to alcohol within Irish society, where harmful drinking is a norm in some cohorts of the population, that like one can't go out and enjoy themselves without having to consume alcohol. Interestingly, I came across something on Facebook recently through a former service user of ours, where a group of people have got together in Cork City and are hosting evenings where tea, coffee and soft drinks are available, and socialising in that manner in a community hall setting to avoid exactly what we've spoken about there, where people feel the need to justify the fact that they have elected not to drink on this occasion. So I thought that was quite interesting. And I believe it's also quite popular.
Yeah, and it's probably encouraging from your point of view, Michael, who works in the area of addiction counselling, that so many people are choosing alternatives or are gaining the confidence to go out and not drink. And while we're not anti-alcohol, you know, it has to be said there that there are a lot of people who can go out and enjoy themselves, have a few drinks and go home. There are a cohort of people, though, who struggle with abuse, struggle with substance misuse and have those issues. And people may not realise it. By asking those questions, why are you not drinking, Asher, go on, have a drink, it can be quite triggering for those people.
Yes, particularly in early recovery, Owen, that where people start to feel awkward around the fact that they are not drinking, because there is the need within us all to socialise. And we actually advise clients to avoid places like pubs in early recovery so that they would avoid feeling this discomfort around not drinking. And can I say, Owen, as somebody who stopped drinking many, many years ago, because I was a problematic drinker, I still go to things like weddings and I get quizzical looks by virtue of the fact that I don't have a pint glass in my hand. You know, it doesn't bother me in the slightest, but I suppose the point I'm trying to make is because the consumption of alcohol is so normalised, the concept of not drinking is then alien to the majority in settings such as that. So, I mean, it's really a question. There are a body of young people out there now that are being very health conscious and fitness conscious, and have elected not to drink because they feel the need not to do so. And I suppose groups of people like that should be applauded for kind of going against an established trend where it was almost a rite of passage in Ireland that people would consume alcohol in social situations, because if you didn't, you were out of step.
And it's interesting that you say that you still get quizzical looks even though you gave it up a number of years ago, but I'm sure what your response to that would be is you become hardened to it. And while it might be tough at the start, you know, you get used to it and you get more confident yourself in going out and not drinking.
Yeah, and I suppose, look, I'm at a stage in my life that I'm quite comfortable to go to things and not drink and not care what kind of quizzical looks or questions might be asked of me by people when they find it unusual that I am a non-drinker. But it is not that straightforward at all for somebody who might be an alcoholic on the one hand, who we deal with, or somebody who may have drank to harmful levels and might have got sense because they could see they were going down a wrong road,
yeah,
or somebody who just elected not to drink because they feel it isn't for them.
And
I suppose we need to be considerate of those people in a general sense.
Yeah, and back to the early point as well that I was making about it being triggering is that very often you don't know the person's background or story, if they have been an alcoholic or a problem drinker, and comments like that could very easily derail their rehabilitation process. As a society, what can drinkers do to make non-drinkers feel more comfortable, do you think, Michael?
Well, I suppose one, in the first case, people should avoid being drawing a conclusion that if somebody is not drinking, that there must be a reason for that. In other words, that they would otherwise be drinking. And I suppose become more accepting of the fact that there are a body of people in Ireland, albeit in the minority, that choose not to drink for various reasons, up to including the fact that they may have an alcohol problem. And just become more considerate in that respect, that when you see somebody out and about at a social occasion and they're not drinking, that maybe there might be a reason that they're not drinking, and maybe it is not necessary to ask these ridiculous questions like, are you pregnant, or are you on antibiotics, or are you driving, or that kind of thing. Incidentally, the person that told me that story told it to me with some degree of amusement.
Yeah.
But for somebody else, it may not be as amusing to them.
Yeah, and the advice, as always then, just to conclude this conversation, Michael, if somebody is listening to this and think that they may have a problem with alcohol or any other substances, reach out, get the help, or if family members are concerned as well, they can do the same. I think it's an important discussion that needs to be opened and chatted about as a society. Should we be normalising sobriety a bit more and encouraging those and helping them along the way, those people who are not drinking and choose to go to social gatherings and not drink? Senior Addiction Counsellor at Coonwira, Michael Geeran. Thanks for joining us on the programme this afternoon, Michael.
You're very welcome on, thank you.
Now, just to keep you up to date, you would have heard this over the past couple of days that the first shipment of grain from Ukraine did leave on Monday, I believe, and got to Istanbul in Turkey within a couple of days. But now officials have said the first shipment of the grain from the Ukraine to the United Kingdom since the war began is expected in 10 days' time. It's millions of tonnes that had been stuck there since Russia invaded in February. Last month, an agreement was brokered by the United Nations to reopen the Black Sea ports, and the first shipment this week went to Lebanon. That was the shipment from Ukraine to Istanbul to check it and then on to Lebanon. So UK can receive that in the next 10 days. And of course, that has affected prices of food, including bread. Now, Owen touched on this on Kildare Today this morning. This was the headline in the Irish Examiner by Noel Baker. Young care leavers are having to sleep in graveyards or cars due to the housing crisis. And Peter Lane is advocacy officer in the Newbridge area with EPIC. That's Empowering People in Care. Hello to you, Peter.
How are you, Ciara? Thanks a million for having us on.
No, thank you for joining us. It's a really horrible headline to read. People sleeping in graveyards, their cars, couch surfing, because they just cannot get access to accommodation in this country.
Yeah, it is. Like, I think every family in the country has probably been touched in some respect by the housing crisis in Ireland. And I think the children and young people coming out of the care system have been really acutely affected by it across the board. I know since 2018, our main thing that comes in is accommodation and homelessness from care leavers. So just a little bit about EPIC, if that's okay. We work with young people and children who have been in care, anyone who has care experience up to the age of 26. I've been working there for about 10 years now, come next month, I think. And just to let you know, I don't cover Newbridge, and I was from Newbridge, all right. But my colleague, Adele, we cover South Dublin, Wicklow, Leash, Offaly, Westmeath and Longford. And we have also an office in Limerick, Galway, and an office in Cork. So we're nationwide, and anyone who is a young person who has care experience, if there's any interest in, you know, experiencing independent advocacy, they can come on and check out epiconline.ie and see what we can do there.
So you can...
My little plug in there, if that's all right.
Absolutely, no, absolutely. Your communications manager, Caroline Reid, I've spoken to her before, and she said this situation for care leavers, it's obviously traumatic in itself, having to, you know, sleep in a car, sleep in any situation rough, but they've already gone through such a traumatic experience growing up and difficulty.
Absolutely, 100%. You've hit the nail on the head there. Like, and we've all come across in the service, we've come across people living in situations where they shouldn't be living. If you think about it, usually across the average age of a person leaving the family home in Ireland, in the latest statistics, is 28 and a half years old. And oftentimes then we're expecting young people who've been traumatised, who've had multiple placements, you know, leaving residential in particular, you know, quite apart from foster care, they're going to be moving out there when they're 18, whether they like it or not. And oftentimes they don't have the, you know, even at the best of times, it could be quite difficult for them to access housing. But now that the housing market has gone so crazy, like, it's very difficult for anybody, any professionals, to find accommodation. So when they're in the market, the same market as everybody else, 18-year-old just out of care, and
you know, they have very little chance.
They're very, very little. There's no chance, unfortunately, at the moment, without considerable intervention by the state. I think one of the things we need to stop thinking about is when we get the child into care, when they turn 18, the state is no longer responsible for them. I think we need to kind of change the paradigm from that to taking care of them until they're ready to be, until they're housed, until they're able to take all at it themselves, you know.
And it seems obvious to ask this question, but come the colder months, the situation is going to be worse.
Yeah. Absolutely. And one of the things, we don't have the data, like, that's one of the things we're calling on is the Department of Housing to actually do research on how many people who are experiencing homelessness come from the care system. Like, if you talk to anybody who's working in homelessness, they'll be able to tell you that, anecdotally, that there is going to be a hugely disproportionate amount of their clientele who've been in care, you know, compared to people who haven't been. So we still don't have the proper data, and I know that there's a longitudinal study underway, but I think for the next budget we really need as a society to have a look at this issue. It's just you know, the young people coming into it, it's the main presenting issue that they come into us with now since 2018 is accommodation. And so we might have the best team of social workers, you might have the best team of aftercare workers and psychologists, all working around this young person. If they don't have a roof over their head, like, they're at nothing, you know.
Peter, I appreciate your time this afternoon. Unfortunately, your line is just a little bit bad there. But of course, Peter Lane is Advocacy Officer with EPIC. That's Empowering People in Care. He described what obviously they do. But it's, if you're living in care now or have experience of living in care, they want you to join their EPIC care community. This information is all on EPIC's website. It's epiconline.ie. There's also a number you can call to get help from. It's 01 872 7661, and of course email info@epiconline.ie. Lots more information about help, etc., their podcasts, their pre-budget submission, obviously incredibly important for this budget that is happening next month. Their pre-budget submission just released last month, and they're noting their capacity as a national children's rights organisation on behalf of the children and young people with whom they work with. It's informed by evidence-based, their submission, from the caseload as well as their research and policy work. So, of course, find more information there. Thank you so much to Peter Lane. That is Advocacy Officer with EPIC.